And our first keynote speaker is Melissa, and she'll be speaking for 35 minutes. So let's give a warm welcome to Melissa.
Anyway, so I'm going to start my time. My name is Melissa C. I'm a recovered compulsive overeater. I'm traveling to you guys from New York this morning. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. And I know I had shared my photos with someone, and I usually like to start off my talk with the photos. So when they get up, you'll be able to see the visual demonstration of what this disease has done to me, where I've been, and I like to show my pictures because it, you know, it gets attention, and it gets attention not just for me, but the awesome power of, you know, of my creator, right? That's really what this is about. This whole program is about forming a relationship with power. That can relieve me from the obsession to eat. And so when you see the pictures, you'll be able to say, wow, okay, yeah. You know, so at the grip of my disease, I was over 300 pounds. I've since released over 160 pounds. You know, the first pictures of me, I had just given birth to my daughter. Now, I've always been a compulsive overeater, but I thought that was my top weight when I had my daughter. And I swore that I would get off that pregnancy weight. You know, here I was, I had a wonderful husband, a baby I always longed for. I was happy. And of course I would lose the weight. And there I am in the pink, my daughter's older and I got larger, right? So being happy and getting what I wanted didn't work. It wasn't the fix for this. And my weight continued to go up and down through the years. I would lose a little weight only to regain it. There's, you know, and then here I am when I'm in that leopard sweater, I'm at the top. That was really where I was at my top weight. Actually, I wasn't holding my son. I longed for that child as well. And I could barely hold him because of the bulk of my body. And that broke my heart, and it wasn't enough. I was still powerless. It wasn't enough to get me to be able to put the food down. I simply couldn't do it. And on the bottom of that photo, there's me in the green before I am with my sisters and my sister-in-laws. And I have a wonderful family. I have a lot of siblings. I have an extended family. They love me. And in this disease, I felt separate, alone, like a monster, you know. I just didn't feel good. Even with people who loved me, I felt very much trapped inside, you know, my body, inside this disease. And I would, you know, this was a family event. We were at my sister's, and I don't know what it was, but I know we were at my sister's. And I know that, like all family events, I either drank a lot and I ate. Right? I ate a lot, and I would often find myself eating in the bathroom, like my pockets filled with something, and I would be in the bathroom eating. And that's a horrible way to spend a day rather than being with people who love and adore you. In the picture, me with both my kids, I had lost some weight. I was on my way. I was, you know, it takes a while to lose 160 pounds. It doesn't happen overnight. And then in the last set of photos, on the last slide, that's me. that's me. And that's been me for a number of years now. And the wonderful, miraculous thing is that all of those dresses fit me. And I know that without trying them on, right? They just fit me. I've been relieved of diets. I've been relieved of food. And I'm free. I feel free. I feel when I'm with my family, I feel happy to be there with them, right? I'm able to have a connection. I mean, look, they're still my family. So they still, you know, we're very much still family, and people still do things that upset me. But I have a process by which I live and I embrace, and I no longer spend family occasions in the bathroom eating. right? So those are my photos. Now I'll give you my story. You know, I'm certain I was born a compulsive overeater. I was chunky as a kid, but my earliest memories were of food, always food. And, you know, I've recently shared this with my some family members, like just memories of food. And the response I got actually when I actually shared it with my husband, he said, "Well, Melissa, everybody has warm memories of food." He's like, I don't know if that's necessarily what, you know, so different from anyone else. And then I reflected on it and I thought, my memories aren't happy memories of food. They're longing. They're memories of longing for more, right? So I would, you know, my mom would always buy a beautiful cake on Fridays, and we would have it Friday night after dinner. And, you know, what I share is that my mother would take the box out, and before my piece was cut, I knew it wasn't enough. Like, I was already longing for what was left in the box. And that was the way that I've experienced food throughout my life. Like, here's my plate, and there's where I'm looking. Always past my plate. Always what's left. You know, and so I grew up sneak eating, right? I could get to the fridge from my bedroom in the dark at a very young age. I knew what floorboards creaked. I could open the refrigerator without the light coming on. You know, I was really skilled at doing that. And not because my parents were horrible people and they, you know, like ruled with an iron. They loved me, and their kid was eating way beyond what was normal and healthy and in my own best interest. And so they tried to moderate me. They tried to limit me. You know, they did the best they could. And most of my life I spent longing and hungering for more. You know, the truth is though, as an adult woman, when I no longer lived with my parents, I still had that experience with food. So I could not blame it on my parents trying to limit me, right? Because I experienced that when I went away to college. I experienced that in my own home. How's that? In my very own home with my husband, food that I bought. And here I am sneaking and longing for more, right? So I can't blame anybody for that. That is just the nature of what it is I have. And, you know, there's a part in the big book, it says, in the chapter, there's a solution. It says, opinions vary considerably as to why the alcoholic, or for us, the compulsive overeater, reacts differently from normal people. We're not sure. Once a certain point is reached, little can be done for him. We cannot answer the riddle. So I think asking the why, I always wanted to know why. Why do I do this with food? And I would say that's an immature question. That's a question of someone who doesn't really want to take action. When I ask why too much, what I'm really looking is to assign blame to another person. Right? And if I could assign blame to another person, then I'm no longer responsible for my actions today. And what I found out in Overeaters Anonymous was, you're not going to find out why. If you're here hoping that today is going to give you the why, you might find out something, but so what? Even if I found out why, even if my parents or society or the food industry did something, right, that tipped the scale, that forced me to become this, I still have to do something about it, right? I'm 52 years old. If I spend my precious time on earth, you know, focusing on what other people did or didn't do, I will never get well, right? That is not, there's no chapter in the book, here's why it happened to you. Right. And really what I found out about asking why is what it really means is I don't like this. Right. When my children would ask me, why do I have to go to bed now? they don't really want a lengthy explanation about the importance of 8 hours of sleep, right? No, what they're saying is I don't want it and make it different. So that's not the solution here for us. I also had a lot of, from people I loved and growing up and even I share a story of my own mother-in-law in my house, right? I got a lot of frothy emotional appeal. And there's a part in the doctor's opinion that talks about frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices, right? What really works is we need a message of depth and weight. And so what is frothy emotional appeal? It's probably the appeal that you've all heard. It's, here's what I heard. Melissa, you had enough. That's enough. You're a beautiful girl. What are you doing? You're a smart girl. I would get it from the doctors. Your blood pressure is dangerously high. You have to do something about this. You're killing yourself, right? Even my husband at one point, he took out pictures of us in our early marriage. And, I had lost a lot of weight before I met my husband. And on my honeymoon, I picked something up and I regained all my weight quickly. And so there was even one time my husband showed me some pictures of us in our early marriage. And he said, oh man, you looked beautiful there. Right? And that's frothy emotional appeal. And it doesn't work. It doesn't work. I also had an experience where my mother-in-law came to my house. My children were babies at the time. And she sat me down and she started to cry. And she shared with me how her own mother died when she was a little girl. And that was a very painful experience for her. And then she witnessed her husband dying when my husband was a very little boy. She lost her husband. She had two very small children. And she said the worst thing in the world that can happen is to lose a parent when you're a child. It's so painful, Melissa. And then she started to cry and she said, and I'm looking at you and you're going to do this to my grandchildren. Right? You don't get like a more frothy emotional appeal than that. And it didn't work. I felt horrible. I felt humiliated and I felt angry, right? And what did I do the second she left? I ate and I didn't answer her call for a while because I was pissed off. So every scheme I tried, every scheme in the book, I have done every single diet repeatedly, over and over and over. And what I found out, it says in More About Alcoholism on page 30, our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove we could drink like other people. The idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. And I just really, really wanted to find a way that I could live, right? That I could eat normal. I could do normal. And, what I wound up doing was every scheme. In fact, in my insanity of this disease, the more expensive the scheme was, the crazier it sounded, the more I threw all my faith into it. I was like, well, this has to work. It has to work, right? And what I say is like, I was like the, I loved the cabbage soup diet. It was like, how, and the crazy thing is I have yet to meet a person who has successfully done that diet, right? And is like, and is a poster child for the power of that diet. And yet I did it over and over and over again, right? And I've tried many other things over and over again. What happened was when I graduated from college, I was 280 pounds and my life it felt like a mess. I had a degree. I'm a pretty smart person, right? I've been able to do well academically. I've been able to do lots of things. But I graduated from college and all my girlfriends were getting the jobs, right, that they wanted. They were they were getting married. They were having babies. They were doing all the things that I wasn't doing. And you know, the way that I've experienced the piece of cake on my plate with my eyes like that, that was the way that I was living my life, right? Here I was, I had all the ingredients for a good life and I couldn't enjoy it. It was, I longed for more. I knew that there was more for me. And I really thought that the answer to getting more would be weight loss. Lose weight and then everything would be great. You know, because I couldn't meet a man in that size. I didn't feel comfortable meeting a husband that way. And I didn't feel comfortable putting myself out on the job market that way. I knew that I looked physically the way that I felt. And so I actually wound up coming to Overeaters Anonymous then, accidentally. And I got some really good information. I found out about an allergy. And what happened was, now the allergy of the body is a really important piece of information, but I didn't really do anything else other than that. I didn't buy into the rest of the steps. So I treated OA like a diet. And it's actually the plan that I was given back then. It's not so different from the way I eat today, right? I was given a sheet with exactly what to eat, what I couldn't eat, how much to eat. And that sheet, and I was also given a big book, right? Now I searched the big book for the diet and I didn't see it. So I thought, well, who needs this? This is stupid. I'm not an alcoholic. This is beneath my consideration, right? And I took it and I shoved it in a drawer. And that food plan was my religion. I worshiped abstinence. Abstinence became God. And I practiced the religion of a food plan, right? And what that did for me was it actually allowed me to lose weight at that point in my life because I was young and I was heavily motivated. And I was blessed in a sense. I got all the things that I wanted from the food plan. And so I figured, hey, food plan works, all is well, right? Until I went on my honeymoon. And the strange mental blank spot happened. That was the part I never got really from the book. You know, there's two stories in the big book that explain what happened to me that gives me information about this. And they're both in More About Alcoholism, which is a very powerful chapter. It could be called More About How I'm Crazy, right? More About Why I Need a Relationship with God, right? That's really what that chapter is to me. Because in the book, it's on page 32, you know, there's the story of the man of 30. And in that story, although I didn't stay dry 25 years like him, I stayed dry more like 5. I fell victim, which practically every alcoholic has, that after his long period of sobriety and self-discipline had qualified him to drink like other men. But like him, I gathered all my forces, attempted to stop altogether, and found I could not. And then there's another story about Fred. And in Fred, everything for him was great. It's on page 41. It says, physically, I felt fine. No pressing problems or worries. It was the end of a perfect day, not a cloud on the horizon. And so what happened for me on my honeymoon was I picked up a frozen tropical drink, right? Which really is ice cream in a glass. Like, that's the truth. It's just, but I picked it up because I thought I was normal. I looked normal. I was a normal size bride. having a normal honeymoon with a husband that I adored in a beautiful tropical place. And I looked around and I noticed other young brides having beautiful frozen tropical drinks. And I thought, of course I can. Of course I can. And I have to tell you, I could mark that day in the calendar, because after that day, it was like I opened up the floodgates, and the rest of my honeymoon I spent eating. And so by the time I came home from my honeymoon, all the gorgeous clothes I had bought for this beautiful trip didn't fit me. I was like squeezing out of my clothes. And the thing that surprised me beyond belief, I couldn't believe it, was that food plan. Remember, my food plan was my religion and abstinence was my God. And they were nowhere to be found when I came home from the honeymoon. I didn't have the power to get back on that plan. And I thought for sure, I thought, I'm having fun on my honeymoon, but for sure when I get home, I'll be able to do it. And I couldn't. It was years of struggling. And it's painful. It's painful. And it's almost abusive to a marriage to gain that kind of weight in early marriage. It because it builds a wall. It puts up a brick wall of fat and food between you and your partner. Someone said to me once in OA, it just ripped my heart. When I was telling my story, this guy says, "Oh, so you did the old bait and switch on the guy." And I thought, oh gosh, that is awful. But I guess I did, right? Because what he met was not really who I was. Thankfully, we're still married. and I'm really, that's just a blessing. And he puts up with this right now, because I told him, like, right when I started talking, I'm like, okay, he's in the other room. I'm like, you have to shut the TV off. Like, it's too noisy. It'll be picked up if they're recording. And I'm grateful that I have someone who understands and appreciates the necessity of this for me. This is crucial for me. Being able to tell my story, being able to be here, it's part of my rehabilitation. It's what keeps me well. I went on for years struggling with food. And, when you know that Overeaters Anonymous exists and you can't find your way back there, it's painful. Right? When you've had a taste of abstinence and you can't seem to summon it up again, it's hard. It's really hard. What I found out in this disease is that I have a very high threshold for pain and I don't surrender easily, and that's why some people, they reach their limit at a certain point. And for me, it was sky's the limit. It just gets worse and worse and worse. In the disease of morbid obesity, I broke toilet seats, right? Humiliating. I couldn't fit in my own kitchen chairs in my kitchen. In my own kitchen, I couldn't fit in the armchairs, right? I would walk onto a plane, and when you're of a certain size, you walk on a plane and everybody kind of looks away and you can feel what they're thinking, right? And what they're thinking is, God, please don't let her sit next to me, right? And really what's worse than that is that I was feeling that inside about myself. Like in my own head, I was like, yeah, if I could have chosen a seat not next to me, I would have chosen that seat too. And that's a horrible way to go through life. That tells me that it's not lack of desire, because I desired recovery more than anything. I don't want to live that way. Nobody's meant to live that way. Feeling like you take up too much physical space to belong, right? I would lie in bed at night, and I would start to cry because I couldn't sleep for fear that I was going to die in the middle of the night. My blood pressure was dangerously high. And I thought, oh my gosh, my family is going to wake up in the morning and they're going to find me dead. And that terrified me, right? To have small children who I wanted and loved and a husband and a wonderful job. And I felt like I was going to die because of eating. And I still couldn't stop. Like, that's the crazy thing is, right? I would lay in bed all night like that. And in the morning, I would repeat again exactly what got me to that spot. I couldn't stop eating. I just couldn't stop. The most wonderful thing happened to me. And it sounds horrible that this was a wonderful thing. I reached a point where the food stopped working. I couldn't get numb. I couldn't consume enough food to shut down whatever it was inside me that needed quieting. I couldn't get enough in me. And what happened was I started getting panic attacks. They were debilitating. And I felt like all my life, I thought, okay, my brain is awesome. I always thought there's nothing wrong with my brain. There's nothing wrong with my thinking. There's nothing. I'm certainly not insane. I just have to stop eating. And then I got these panic attacks and I thought, okay, I'm losing my mind and I can't eat it away. I couldn't eat the panic down. And that was a blessing. That really was a blessing. You know, so what happened? On page 25, it says, the great fact is just this and nothing less, that we have had deep and effective spiritual experiences which have revolutionized our whole attitude toward life, toward our fellows, and towards God's universe. The central fact of our lives today is the absolute certainty that our Creator has entered our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. He has commenced to accomplish those things which we could never do by ourselves. It goes on to say, right, in this part here, a little bit further, it says, passed into the region from which there was no return through human aid. And I had but two alternatives. One was to go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of this intolerable situation as best we could. And the other was to accept spiritual help. And my situation was intolerable and I couldn't blot it out. And that was a gift. And I cried out. I really did. I cried out for God. I remember like just saying, God help me, I'm screwed. And not long after that, I began to really take the program of action seriously. You know, my last binge, I ate till my mouth bled. And that's when I cried out because I had blood in my mouth. It didn't taste good. It didn't feel good. And it didn't get me to zero, which was what I was trying to get to. And that's when I cried out for help. And it was there. It was there. You know, what did I do? What do you do when you cry out for help? You follow directions and you take the steps, right? And, you know, I took them one after the other intensively and without debating and without delaying. You know, step one is more than just admitting that I have a problem with food and specific types of food. Step one means that I embrace this specific concept that's found in the doctor's opinion. And it comes at the end of the explanation about the allergy, which remember, the only thing I used to think about was the allergy, right? But I didn't look at what came right after. And here's what it says. It says, this phenomenon, as we have suggested, may be the manifestation of an allergy, which differentiates these people and sets them apart as a distinct entity. So step one means that I absolutely accept and embrace the fact that I am distinct. I am different. I am not like normal people. And what I say is, you know, if you're unsure, right, what that means, take a piece of paper, fold it in half. On one half of the page are the people who can eat what they want. They can gossip. How's that? They can be mad at their boss. They can get in the ring about the political state of this nation. They can have an opinion about all kinds of things. They can revisit the past and what their parents did to them and didn't do to them. They can not repay any debts that they owe. They don't have to apologize for things. They can go on vacation and just easily eat, have a tropical drink, come back on, and all is well, right? And then there's people that live on the other side of the page, the distinct entity. And I have to, you know, have entire abstinence around my food, not eating anything that has any allergic ingredients or engage in any alcoholic food behaviors. I can't gossip. I can't revisit old hurts that, you know, from my past. I have to clean up my debts. I have to work a rigorous program. I have to start my morning in prayer and meditation. I have to, there's lots of things that I have to do because I'm a distinct entity. But the wonderful thing I found out in this fellowship of OA is that, well, there's 46 participants in this meeting. So I know that there's 45 other people right now that live on that page with me. Not alone on that side of the page, but I am distinct and I'm different from other people. And there is a plan for people that are different and distinct, thank God. You know, step two says to form your own conception. And really, early on in recovery, I wasn't interested in God. I thought I was too smart. How's that? You know, contempt prior to investigation. I thought it was beneath my consideration, right? I'm eating till my mouth bleeds. But what you have to say about God and the spirit of the universe is somehow beneath me. And what I found out was, you know, my creator came to me in a voice that my creator knew I could hear. And the voice I actually heard was in my head. It was my dad's voice. And my dad has passed and I had a wonderful father. And the voice I heard was, because I said, see, I'm so smart. I said, well, you just told me that my brain is broken. And now you want me to use my broken brain to form my own conception. And what I heard was the voice of my father saying, you're not, don't be so smart. Don't be so smart. You want to get well or not? And it was, I know it wasn't, I know my God is not my dad, but I know God knows how to speak to me in a voice that got my attention. And it did. And so if you're here, you don't have to be so smart, right? Lay aside everything you think you know to have a new experience and an open mind. Create a relationship with the only power, right? We have only one power that can relieve us from the obsession to eat compulsively. In fact, we're people who must have an experience with the miraculous. That's what we're told in step one, nothing short of a miracle. So if I believe that, then I'm gonna pursue a miracle like my life depends on it, because it does, right? Step three, I found out, okay, this miraculous power, I'm gonna put everything on that power. I'm gonna let go. You know, what I found out too is that I'm like a dog that thinks it's in charge. And dogs that think it's in charge bite, they run amok, they're frightened dogs. You know, the best dogs that I've ever owned are really happy to not be the head dog. They're happy to be lovingly disciplined by a caring disciplinary, you know, force. And that's how I have to look at God. God is in charge of the discipline of me. I put it all in God's hands. And I trust and rely on that power. I have but two alternatives, trust or not trust. If I don't trust, I kill myself with food. If I trust, I can live free. You know, I say the rest of the steps, right? I've got like just a few seconds left, but what I want to say is that every step when taken appropriately and correctly, it's almost thinking about when you're actually taking steps on a staircase. Your feet at some point leave the step you're on and they're dangling. And if it's done correctly, the desire to put your foot on the next step is overwhelmingly great. And that's the way that I needed to take the steps. Embrace it completely. Take them entirely. I made really hard amends. But I knew, well, I had only one other choice. Go back to the food or clean it up. And in my relationship with this power that I needed, I trust and relied on God for the outcome, even with those hard amends. If God put it in my heart to do what was right, then he was in charge of what happened thereafter. You know, I just want to say that living in 10, 11, and 12 is not a catchphrase for me. It is the structure of my life. This is the roadmap of my life. This is how I live today. I owe everything to Overeaters Anonymous, truly. It has saved my life. I met my creator through these rooms. The fellowship introduced me to God. It brought me to my own relationship with God, and I found my purpose here, right? And so it truly is an honor and a privilege, and I wish you all just a beautiful, beautiful day and a beautiful path on recovery. And with that, I will pass.
Thank you, Melissa. That was a wonderful talk. I got a ton out of it. I think we're all really lucky that you joined us all the way from New York. And thanks to whomever invited Melissa, because that was just a fabulous way to start off our spring convention. So thank you.